Welcome to Crossroads. My name is Alicia Triggs, and I serve on First Impressions. So you've probably seen me hold open a door, maybe I helped you to a seat, or maybe I trained you in FI 101. You have come to us in the midst of a series called The Story, where we're learning the story of God as told through the Bible. What I've been reflecting on in this series is how in the eternal timeline of God's story, I am just this little speck. On the other hand, I am just as significant as the people he used to tell his story. At Crossroads, we don't assume that everybody agrees with everything. This is a place where you can ask questions, learn who God is and what that means to you. We're just glad you're here. So sit back, relax, and welcome to the story.
Exterior, the nation of Israel, across generations. God has chosen a people as his own to work through them his plan for redemption.
God is relentless in his pursuit of humanity, to redeem them from their fallen state and give them the fullness of life he originally intended. He promises the Israelites that if they give him their allegiance as king, he will receive them as his people and redeem them.
Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation.
God sets up a system of priests that allow Israel to be led by God directly. He speaks through prophets and leads them with pillars of fire. But they grow nervous of the freedom that following God as their king allows them and reject him, asking God for a human king. God warns them that a king will fail them. Their lack of trust leads to thousands of years of war, slavery, and destruction under kings like Saul and David.
Interior the temple, Jerusalem, during the rule of Rome.
Despite their unwillingness to trust him, God was determined to fulfill his promise to send a redeemer, the final king over God's kingdom. The promised one, Jesus, comes and lives a life of unwavering obedience to God, modeling for the Israelites what true allegiance looks like.
I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does.
As a man, Jesus submits his life fully to God and is made king over all creation.
Interior upper room in Jerusalem, Last Supper. Jesus speaks to his closest followers just before he is arrested.
If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I've told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete.
Jesus wants those who follow him to have a life of joy, and he tells them the only way to real joy is to receive him as King and Lord and to obey his commands. Jesus asks for his followers' allegiance, not to control or oppress them, but to lead them into the fullness of life. Jesus invites his fallen, broken people to join in the royal family, to accept his lordship, to give him all allegiance, allows him to set his people free.
God, I pray that you would help us to see your kingdom in a way that we haven't before, for some of us for the very first time, and you being at the head of it. I pray that we would recognize you not just as one who has limited ability or limited spiritual value, but as a king. I pray that what I say today would be helpful because it is accurate. I pray that you would use it to form our hearts, inform our minds, and actually influence our actions. And I pray these things according to your character, in the name of Jesus. Amen. Well, good morning. It's great to have you here today. If you're new here today, you've caught us right in the middle of a series we're doing called The Story, and it's a linear series where things are building one upon each other. We're looking at what it's like to be in the story of God, as opposed to my personal story, me being the author of myself, the director of myself, the leading character, that actually God is doing something above and beyond me, outside of time, even before the foundations of the earth, We talked about the cosmos. We talked about how the earth was formed in beauty. We talked about how there was a fall, how there was sin that entered the world. It was the bad news of this. And then we talked about how Jesus came in as the ultimate Jew in the midst of the nation of Israel, and how he died on the cross and rose from the dead. I mean, a lot of stuff. If you're new today, you're not very familiar with this story, we've got a website. You can go and get caught up. But these things are sequential learnings as we build on each other. And today we're looking at what it means for Jesus to actually be king in this kingdom that he has. Have I been the only one that's been waking up in the morning, seeing rain, and getting mad? I do, I'm telling you. I get up in the morning, I look at it, I'm like, oh my goodness, are you kidding? Rain, go away, come again another decade. Enough. And then I catch myself and I think, gosh, what good is your anger going to do? I mean, what are you going to do, be mad at God or something like that? Then I feel helpless. But then I realize, no, actually, the rain is a sign that we live in a broken world. We live in a broken world where things go wrong. I mentioned a couple weeks ago, I'll say it again, that I am broken. Brian Tome is broken. I have problems. I have sin in my life. I have things that are not right about me. I do things that I shouldn't do. I don't do things that I should do. I have issues in my life. All of us do. It's called being tainted by sin, as all of creation is tainted by sin. This is the bad news. Bad news. And until we've grappled with the bad news of our condition, the bad news of the world we live in, nothing will be good news, because God contrasts his ways with the ways of this world. And actually, the rain is an example of the bad news in a broken world. Four times our average rainfall in April. Farmers not being able to grow crops. People dying of tornadoes, hurricanes down south. Tsunamis happening. Bad stuff. Reminded that Jesus, one time he was in a boat and he was sleeping, and his disciples were in the midst of a storm in that boat, and they were freaked out by the waves and the wind, and they wake up Jesus, and the Bible says he stands up and he rebukes, that's an exact quote, he rebukes the wind and the waves. So even weather patterns are out of joint. The Bible said in the book of Romans that all of creation groans awaiting redemption. This is the situation that we find ourselves in, and that's why Jesus brings the gospel. The New Testament talks about the gospel of Jesus Christ, and many of us think that the word gospel is just some religious spiritual word. The gospel! You know, no, it's really not. Gospel is an ancient word in all ancient civilization, which meant good news. In fact, archaeologists have unearthed ancient inscriptions that say, the beginning of the gospel of Caesar Augustus. The beginning of the gospel of Caesar Augustus, basically his memoirs, his records. The Romans believed that Caesar was going to bring good news. Good news. He's going to feed. He's going to bring bread. He's going to bring a peace. Good news. The gospel of Caesar Augustus. We're here this marathon weekend. Those of you who could brave traffic, who could actually find a route to get here, which many people have a problem getting here today, and we're not able to get here. Those of us here, we're here, and every time there's a marathon, I'm reminded of gospel. Marathon actually comes back from ancient gospel, ancient good news, when Greece and Persia were involved in a war. And Greece won back-to-back battles. The battle at sea, Salamis, and at Marathon. And when they won Marathon, there was a runner who roughly ran 26.2 miles, burst basically into Greek parliament and said, we've won. He brought gospel, good news, we won. And then he fell over and died. And people run marathons. I don't understand you people at all. If then he falls over and dies, he says, we won, good news. And then what the Greek leaders did is they sent heralds out to all the outlying layers. And these heralds, believe it or not, were called evangelists. These heralds were called evangelists in Greek. Evangelists went out and proclaimed the good news, saying, someone has fought for you and you are free. Someone who has fought for you and you are free. Historians believe this is perhaps the most important war that's ever been won in human history. That if the Persians would have beaten the Greeks, much of what we know that is good in Western culture would be gone. The saplings of democracy would have been squashed that we get from Greece. Philosophy, some of the finer points of philosophy, some certain brands of arts, the rights of the individual, these things were Greek thought, and if they had been squashed, if Xerxes had his way with Persia, likely those things would never have spread to some of the things that are good in Western society. It was good news. This is the good news of Jesus Christ. Good news. He has come. He has died for you. He has fought for you. He's actually risen from the grave. He's fought. You are free. You are free. Jesus doesn't come bringing advice. He doesn't come bringing rules. He doesn't come bringing morality. He doesn't come bringing a new religion. He comes bringing good news. Good news that there is one who lived the life that Brian Tome couldn't live, who died the death that Brian Tome deserves, and all of us does, and actually comes back. This is good news. Gospel. Woo-hoo! Yay! Well, when you take a look at some of the things that we depict Jesus, we oftentimes forget this. We don't see it at all. You know, our artwork tells us a lot about who Jesus is, what we expect of him. Our art picture is worth 1,000 words, and oftentimes our art doesn't depict the magnitude of what Jesus has done, who he is. Let's take a look at some of these art images and see if you can see what this depicts. This is, I would call, gender-neutral Jesus. This is, you look at this, and who is Jesus? I don't know, is he a guy? Is he a woman? I don't know. I'm not sure. Other artwork you might have in your house, your grandmother might have in your house, this one right here. I call this one Bearded Lady Jesus. Yes, you look at this and you think, well, this isn't really somebody brings to do. This is like a little dainty, nice little guy who must be using ivory soap and never had a pimple. And it certainly is not a blue-collar construction worker. He actually was. This image doesn't look at all what Jesus looked like. The next one here, this is BG Jesus. This is BG Jesus.
Stay alive.
Yes, stay alive, Jesus. Resurrected Jesus, also known as Euro Jesus. Euro Jesus. Have you noticed that all our images of Jesus here in America are white? White Jesus? Let me tell you something. If you ever need to understand that we've been deluded with an image of Jesus not real, if you've ever picked Jesus as white, I'm sorry, the guy was from the Middle East. He was darker than me. He was darker than me. And yet our images go to certain things that aren't real because we've never seen the good news of the fullness of his personality and who he is. Here's another one of Jesus. This is Jesus is my homeboy. Yeah, you, I like you. This is Jesus, my co-pilot. Me and he here buds. He doesn't bum me out. He's always there for me. You know, we don't see Jesus here as any important figure, a king. He's equals. He's, you know, nice, loving guy. This one here has always oogied me out. I will call this Spooky Jesus. Actually, a guy I know, Spooky Jesus. What is he, a cannibal? What is he? He's holding a heart that's beating and beaming, and there's a cry. I don't understand. I'm sure there's points to this, but I don't understand it. And you probably don't either, but this has made you think, oh, Spooky, I don't know. He's just weird. The dude is like, you know, he's out there. Here's another one. This one is Precious Moments Jesus. Also Sunday School Jesus. I had this kind of Jesus when I was in Sunday school, and unintentionally, what I learned was, once you grow up, once you have a mind that fully functions, you don't leave Jesus, you leave him behind. Jesus is for little children, you leave him behind, because then you got to get on the real stuff. That was what I believed, because that's what Jesus is. He's comfortable with the small and the naive. But real big problems, capital P problems, real adult problems, no. No, not helpful at all. That's at least what I heard when I was a kid. And this one right here, this is Kick Your Butt Jesus right here. This is Charlton Heston Jesus. There's all kind of different ones like this. Jesus is going to come back, not just on a horse. He's going to have a rifle in his saddle, and he's going to take people down who bum him out. And then last one that, I don't know, I just kind of thought was funny. He cares even for the dinosaurs. I don't think that's funny, but these images, none of these images really depict the fullness of the good news. Good news that he has come to set you free. God himself has taken on flesh to bring you good news. In fact, our artwork that we have, which you see on the side of highways, billboards, has nothing to do with gospel, has nothing to do with good news. What part of thou shalt not don't you understand, God? Well, that's good news right there. Woo, yeah, that'll, God still smites. Yes, he actually does. He does, but that's not the way to lead a conversation. No one understands the kind. Or how about you're saying, don't make me come down there, God. And people who somehow claim to be in the gospel of Jesus, which is not a bus ticket to heaven. It is an overarching kingdom that brings good news. We don't know how to talk about who Jesus actually is. It's good news. The proclamation. Come on, someone's come to set free. Now, here's where this linear thing starts to build up in the story. We can start to see how things start to connect and weave all the way through. Jesus is referred to in the New Testament. One of his monikers is the second Adam. There is the first Adam. And there is the second Adam. You know, the first Adam was created, he was on earth, and he basically put himself on the throne. God said to he and Eve, one thing I don't want you to do, don't take of that fruit, that tree, don't do that. They ended up figuring out, no, I'm going to do that. We're going to do that for whatever reason. We're going to do that. It was a definition of him wanting to be supreme, him wanting to be in control, him wanting to not have any boundaries placed on him at all. He's the first Adam. He's Adam. And then the Bible refers to Jesus as the second Adam. Here's one of the places it does it in the book of 1 Corinthians. It says this. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven, or the cosmos. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, all of us bear the image of Adam, so we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. So here we see the first man, Adam, then the second Adam. We see all these definitions of who Jesus is and contrasting Jesus with Adam. Yet at the same time, there are some similarities in that both of them have downlines that go to people groups. Here's what it says in the book of Romans. For if because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness, that's gospel way, that's good news, free gift, not earned, not paid for by you, free gift of righteousness, reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. So it says the similarity is Adam as a representative of humankind, I'm on his downline. I inherit his sinfulness, his selfishness, his pridefulness. He and Eve's desire to be at the center of the story. I'm all of us by nature are on his downline. But you can also be on the downline of Jesus where all of his righteousness actually gets transferred to your account. So God doesn't look at me and see Brian Tome, who's got all problems. He actually looks at me and sees the righteousness of Christ because I'm on his downline. What does this mean? Let's contrast these two ways of living, because in here we have people who are of the domain of Adam, and we have in here people who are of the domain of Jesus. Let's contrast what those two domains look like that we saw in Corinthians and other places in the Bible. Here's a little graph for you. The first Adam was flesh, and spirit was breathed into him. You may remember that God creates Adam, creates him out of dust, and then breathes spirit into him. Jesus, on the other hand, he's always been in the spirit, always existed, and then he takes on flesh. He comes through Mary's womb and actually takes on flesh. It's the exact opposite of Adam. Here's another one. The first Adam chooses himself in the garden. He's in the garden, and he chooses, I want that tree. I want that. It's not good enough that I have everything else I can do, all kinds of other generous blessings. But I want that one. He chooses himself. Jesus is also in a garden. It's called the Garden of Gethsemane. Adam's in the Garden of Eden. Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus, when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, he knows he's going to be arrested, tried, and crucified. He doesn't like it. He's sweating blood. And he says to God, I really would rather not do this. There's a better way. I'm up for it. But not my will be done, but your will be done. He chooses obedience. The first Adam chooses himself. Second Adam chooses obedience. Another contrast. The first Adam became living. The second Adam actually gives life. When you get on Jesus' downline, he actually gives you life. He enables you to get over your brokenness. He enables you to get over your wounds. And not only that, you're here, whether we believe in God or not. We're here because of God bestowing life, the blessing of life. No human being makes life happen. But the second Adam does. The first Adam originated on earth. The second Adam originated in the cosmos and has always been the firstborn of all creation, the one who existed before all the earth was, who actually was the spoken word in Genesis 1 that spoke things into being. A lot of deep stuff I'm throwing at you today. Some of this stuff, oh, I never heard of. Yeah, some of God's story is so deep, I can't boil it down to it and make it so simple inside of 35 minutes. Story is deep. I stand in a deep stream. Here's another one. The first Adam has descendants of dust, all of us naturally descendants of dust. The second Adam has descendants of the cosmos who will live forever and ever and ever in oneness with God. When we choose to be on Adam's downline, which is our default mode, be on Adam's downline, when we go to funerals, what happens? Ashes to ash, dust to dust. Death rate is right at 100%. All of us are going to have a funeral done for us at some point. And that little saying has popped up because we began with dust. Our dad, Adam, was formed out of dust. And all of us will go back into dust. We will decompose and become worm food. Originates in dust. We end. That's end of Jesus. There is the descendants of the cosmos who exist forever and ever. An eternal kingdom that will not fade away. The first Adam, last one. All humans bear his image. All of us are on his downline. The second Adam, only some humans bear his image. Some of us do. Some of us are grafted into him and look to him as king. King, yes, king. We don't oftentimes use that phrase for Jesus, king, but it's what he is. He is king. He is king of a kingdom. The Bible speaks that his kingship is actually a reward from his heavenly Father for his obedience, for overcoming the curse and the normal way of the world of Adam. It says this in the book of Philippians chapter 2. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. So at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God. Of God the Father. God has highly exalted him. In the Greek, it's hooper. Hooper exalted him, or hyper exalted him, or in German, uber exalted him. He highly exalted him. Why? Because of his obedience, and gave him the name above every name. And that still exists today. Be in a crowded room and just go, Jesus, and just stop. I'll go, ooh. Say Adam, no one's going to turn around and say Cheryl. So no one's going to say Janine. No one's going to say Jesus. So we go, ooh, ooh. It's a name that is above every name. And at that name, every knee will bow. Every knee will bow. I choose, because he is my king, I choose to bow my knee to him and him to be the authority in my life. And this is a voluntary thing that I do. It's something I do out of submission, out of joy, because he's a king that brings good news. But everybody, that verse says, will bow. Does this mean everybody gets to heaven? No, it's not saying that. It's saying that even some people who choose to go the way of Adam, the way of your own personal kingdom of dust, the way that you want to define life, not coming under the authority of God, you will be a vanquished foe, and you will be driven to your knees as any vanquished foe is, and with clenched teeth saying, you win, you are Lord. Not happy about it, but you are Lord. Every knee shall bow. If you disagree, agree, doesn't matter. You will bow. You will bow. It's a matter if it's one of submission and of joy because of the good news of a king who's good, or because you just didn't want to have any part of that kingdom. You would not take instructions from anyone. You would do it your own way. Eventually, we will learn the folly of our ways. Some of us, we like Jesus, we give homage to him various ways, but it's not a full-on loyal subject, not as someone who's under his kingship. We'll go take Jesus off the shelf every once in a while. We need something. So, man, I need to get me some Jesus. So we have a little cross that we hang around. And this cross, for many of us, it just symbolizes that we're in the club. It symbolizes, that's who I am. Maybe it's a little good luck charm. Maybe we get admitted to the hospital and we have to check what religion we are. And we say, well, I'm not Muslim, not Hindu, definitely not other, whatever that is. So, yeah, Christian, yeah. So of all the different options, I'll just kind of pull my Christianity off the shelf and display it when I need to. Others of us, when we're in need of something, we'll go to Jesus. Well, I go to Jesus and I get, oh man, I just feel hurting. I'm hurting. I need Jesus to cuddle me and snuggle me. This big bad world has just bothered me. I need snuggy Jesus. Hold me and just make me feel good. And world's a hard place. Oh, it is. It is a hard place. And Jesus absolutely gives me comfort. I go to him, my times of trial absolutely is. But some of us, we just want to go to our Jesus concept when we need something. And then, oh, okay, I feel better. Feel better. Okay, good. Enough of that. On to getting on with my life. Or some of us, he's our secret to somehow getting what we want financially. I need to go to church. I need to do a little this and that because he's all about my wealth, right? My health or my wealth. And I gotta check the Jesus box or do different things in order to have that in my life. Some of us, our parents, when we came to Crossroads, initially because of our kids. I think it's a good thing. I think it's interesting how God oftentimes gets to adults through kids. I know many adults that said, man, I just need to get someplace for my kid to get some spirituality. And what do you know? They come to Crossroads and their kid starts growing. And all of a sudden, somewhere along the way, they come to know Jesus personally. Awesome, amazing stuff with that. Some people never cycle out of that. They view Jesus as a little vitamin that they want to pop for their kids. I need some help for my kids, a little more morality. I need to get them around Jesus. I need to get them some religion. Doesn't affect my life on a 24/7 basis, but I need it for my kids. It's just something I have to go and get. Or maybe years ago, you said, oh man, this idea of a possible hell, I can't have that. I need to get myself a fire insurance policy. So you have a fire insurance policy. Just in case, so maybe you got baptized, maybe you said a prayer, maybe you walked an aisle, but you said, I got my fire insurance policy, and maybe there's a monthly premium you pay on your fire insurance policy. Maybe your premium is you go to church once a week, once a month, maybe you do this, maybe you do that, but really, there's mechanical things you do to keep the policy up, but really, it's just on a shelf. It doesn't affect the totality of your life, and then some of us have pictures all around our house. As I said earlier, a picture's worth 1,000 words. It tells us what we're thinking. And many of us in our house, our pictures tell us what we're thinking or specifically what our dreams are. We have posters. We have catchy phrases. We have and oftentimes, our pictures in our house are our dreams, whatever our dreams are. And so we want to find a God, find a Jesus that will validate my dream and give me my dream. It's about my dream. It's about you helping me. That's what Adam was. Adam had his dream. It was called his little corner of the world, his piece of dust. And we'll sometimes have just enough of God in order to get this dream that we really want. This is the default mode. This is the default. This is the way of Adam, these things. The way of Jesus, the way of under his kingship, is to come and say, I want you. If you give me any of these things, great, but I want you. You're who I want. I've been following Jesus for about 30 years now, and when I first started following him, there was a lot of intramural debates over various beliefs. There's different intramural debates that happen inside of Jesus' kingdom. There always is. There's always a new hot bucket debate, that hot topic debate that people are having. The big one decades ago was whether or not it was a two-step process coming into relationship with Jesus, that the first step was receiving him as Savior, so I get forgiveness for my sins, I ask him in my life, I get my fire insurance policy, and for some people, that's just kind of where they say it. He's their Savior. And then the second step would be when you receive him as Lord and Savior. That's when you really get serious. You say, okay, I'm going to actually follow you. And some people will debate, are those two different steps, the one the same? Let me tell you something. I've followed Christ for 30 years. It's actually a 167,000-step process. It never ends. It is a daily conscious decision to bring my life into conformity with him and to bow my knee and say, I want your kingdom. I want your life, not mine. Some of us, it's maybe uncomfortable for you to see a grown man kneeling. We don't see people kneeling very often unless they're groveling. It's odd for us. We're not in a in an environment that we understand authority. We don't see that. We normally don't have that in my life. I tell you, this is not uncomfortable for me at all. I kneel oftentimes when I pray, and even when I'm not praying, when I'm at my best, when I have my spiritual sanity, I am in a posture of kneeling all the time because I want His life to emanate through my life. I want my life to be in conformity with Him. But many of us, it's uncomfortable because we haven't seen this, but we're outside of the idea of authority in our culture. I mean, who is a king to us? Who's an absolute authority? Our boss, maybe, but then, you know, we can get another job and screw you, I'm getting a new job. Away we go from them. You know, we live in democracy. You know, we don't like them. We just vote them out. And we should. We should vote them out. I'm sorry. That was one thing that all Americans seem to be agreed on. Democrats, Republicans, whatever. Get them out. Whatever. We have a system. We can just get away all those elected authorities. And then when we hear about a king in another part of the world, such as in England, the royal family, how many of us, by the way, watched the royal wedding recently? How many? Yeah. Interesting. The ladies are always the ones that clap. Ooh, yeah. Ooh. Interesting. I've never heard any guys say, yeah, awesome. Anyway, interesting little wedding. We're drawn to royalty here in America, but that royalty actually has no power. They are impotents. They're kings. In fact, even if you live in England, the Queen Mum has nothing to do with your life. Doesn't set policy, doesn't set procedure. So even our images of royalty have been neutered. We so rarely understand authority. Is there anything in your life that you are doing only because Jesus said so and He modeled it? Then He's your king. Is there anything in your life? If there's not anything in your life that you're doing different as a result of Jesus, then you're of Adam's lineage, not Jesus's. I remember one of the defining moments for me. And again, there's hundreds of thousands of these. I was 33 years old. Crossroads had been going for a couple years, and there was a group of guys that I built into, a group of guys that come to know Christ through our relationship, and I was trying to build into them spiritually, and decided to baptize them. And as I was thinking about it, I thought, you know, I've never done that personally. I do infant baptisms. I've done them. It's all fine. It's good. Or infant dedications. That's cool. And I realized the only reason why I'm really not being baptized now is I'm kind of embarrassed. What if people think that I didn't do this or I do that? I mean, I am a pastor. I'm 33. And the only reason I could think of was selfish reasons of my own dust. And so when I got baptized, 33, at Crossroads, it was a sign of submission, a sign of submission. And Jesus says, go into all the world, make disciples, and be baptized. It was a submission thing. I had all kinds of ways to talk my way around it, but it was one of the many, many steps of being His. See, Jesus brings authority. He is authority. One of the interesting ways this was communicated was when there was a guy who lived when he lived, who was a Roman centurion. Again, the Romans, they were oppressing Jews. And yet this Roman centurion was well thought of the Jews. Perhaps it's because this one Roman centurion maybe contributed to building campaigns, maybe he was nice, but we don't really know exactly why. But Jesus is out doing His ministry, and some Jewish leaders came to Jesus and said, hey, there's this Roman centurion who's an official over at least 100 people. This Roman centurion, he's got somebody in his household, a servant who's sick. It means a lot to this guy. And would you go and help him out? Maybe do your healing voodoo magic on him because it would be great. And Jesus says, all right. Maybe Jesus heard of this guy and had fond affection towards him. Maybe he just wanted to appease these religious leaders. I don't know why, but he said, okay. So he starts making his way to the Roman centurion's house, and this guy finds that Jesus is coming to his house, and he quickly sends another servant out to intercept him and send him a message. And here's what the servant delivers to Jesus from the centurion's own heart. But say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. Centurion sends word, says, oh, Jesus, ho, I understand authority structure. I am an authority. I tell my people they got to do something, and they simply do it. I understand it. And I understand you are the authority. So you don't even need to come here. You just need to say the word. Just say the word, and they're going to be healed. Just say the word. This is what somebody who's on Jesus' downline said. Just say the word, God, word. Just say it. What is it? I'm not going to talk myself out of it. I'm not going to go the pattern of the masses. Just say the word. Jesus looks at all the Jews who are high on their own nationality and their spirituality, and he said, I got to tell you, a dirty Roman Gentile. I've not found this kind of faith even amongst my brethren. And this guy gets it. He has it understood. Do we understand the kingship, the authority, the mandates of a king? It kind of goes both ways too. Sometimes when preachers or me will talk about this, we talk about, he's a king. You got to submit. He's under authority. You better do it. And sometimes that's the appropriate tenor to take. But if that's the only tenor you take, it's really not healthy, because we always say, it's good news. It's good news. He's the one who's come and died. He's the one who has not come to extract taxes. It's good news. It's both of these things together. The intense strength and the unbelievable sacrificial love coming together. This is a king that's unlike any other king. He governs a kingdom that's unlike any other organization or any other realm of being. And what's it look like if you were to go from the realm of Adam, the realm of having your own dust, your piece of the pie, your dreams, your religion, your spirituality, your viewpoints, your politics, the things that work for you? What would happen if you went from you being king to actually kneeling before? There's three things. There's actually more, but I only have time for three. So here's one. And I'll just speak for me personally. Jesus influences my actions. Jesus influences that. He influences actions. There must be tangible, tactile, concrete, measurable ways that life is different. Otherwise, he's a king in name only, and he's not your king. He's not my king. There must be measurable difference. And if there's no, if your life is the same as it was 5 years ago, if your life looks the same as the nice agnostic who's beside you in your neighborhood or in your office, dude, get a clue. You are of Adam. You are of Adam. There's a king that has a higher standard, a higher calling, and it's good. It's good. This photo I ran across recently over in Japan, you can see these markers all over hillsides in coastal regions in Japan. They are generations after generations old, and they basically say, don't put your house beneath this point. The ancient elders of villages in Japan, or the rulers of Japan, when they would go through tsunamis, they would take a stone and they would put it right up to where the water came, and they would park it there, and they would say, don't build your house anywhere beneath this. And these are still all over the landscape. Some people were spared because their villages that they're in are above all these stones. But for most people, you can see a stone is, it wasn't taken care of. There's brush all around because people just forgot it. Oh, whatever. That's just a saying. And they actually went downwind of the stone and are dead now. The authorities that lived before put these monuments out of love to warn future generations. And I have a king who doesn't come to me just to extract taxes out of me. And I have a king that has my best motives at heart. He influences my actions. Again, hundreds of thousands of examples I could have for this of recognizing him as king. At one time, I was sitting in a chair not too unlike this one in the atrium, the original part of our building. I can't talk this way on Saturday nights to say original part of our building, because the Saturday night DVD goes to Mason and later Florence, so I got to try to keep it site neutral, you know. So it's nice to say, over there in the original building, we moved out of a rented space over in Hyde Park, and we came over here, and man, I'll tell you what, it was an exhilarating time. Church was growing. We doubled in 3 months, tripled in 6 months. People coming out all out of the woodwork, people coming to know Jesus, powerful times. People who did come from other churches, which we never set ourselves up for people to come from other churches, but nonetheless, they did come from other churches, and there was a rebirth, a renewal in faith. I mean, it was amazing times, but it was also sobering for me. I found myself in a building that was already maxed out just 6 months after it had been built. And I went, gosh. I sat during the week one day, I sat out in the atrium in the couches and I just had some time with God and I was just, God, is this what the next few decades of my life look like? We develop relationships with people, with friends, and we bring them to a place called Crossroads to help us communicate who Jesus is. They come to know Jesus. It's amazing stuff happens. They want to take it to their friends. They come, and we grow, and also we've got to have a campaign. We've got to go through the hard stuff of laying down our stuff, casting vision, sacrificing, taking away savings, and then we build a building, and we've got all the crunching of hiring architects, figuring out how all that goes, and you got a building, and you got to get all your volunteer systems down, get more and more volunteers, and bam, it fills up. More and more people. And then we got to have what? Then I have another campaign, go to the, and then have another architect. You know, I'm going, is this what I'm in for? I'm at this point, I'm 35 years old. I'm going, I don't know if I can do this for the next four decades of my life. And that's when God really rebirthed in us and in me a vision for the kingdom of God, that God is pro churches growing and more people coming. We will always do it. We will always be people who are not here. It's always awesome. And if that's as far as we went, we would be out of the will of God, because God does not just want religious organizations to grow. He wants a movement to come across the region to be a blessing. Out of that, people started having visions for Kaleidoscope or WizKids, Kaleidoscope WizKids. We started getting behind helping people in poverty here in our city. We started getting behind more significant ways in South Africa. We started, you know, putting big amounts of money and stuff that would never grow our attendance or anything. And why? Because it was submission to the king. Because the king said, I don't want just you to bring people to me and fill up services. You need to sacrifice and go out and be about the least of these and bring substantive change, influence my actions. By the way, why we do Go Cincinnati every year? It's an example how we want to get in the city and bless them. And by the way, here we go, a little public service announcement. Last year we had 5,500 people who did Go Cincinnati. It's a four-hour blitz. We help organizations in our city work with people who are in a hard place. And as of this morning, we only have 3,000 people signed up. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but there's massive ramifications if we can't hit at least 5,000 people to the organizations we serve. Massive, massive ramifications. And for me, when I found out about Go Cincinnati, when I know it is, I put it on my calendar as a recurring thing that happens every year, because for me, it's a submission to the king. And I'll tell you what, if you're here at Crossroads, man, give yourself a blessing. Give yourself a good day, 4 hours. It's 4 hours. Build into somebody else. And if you're sitting there going, man, that's just not my gig, I'd say, dude, you haven't a clue. Come on. Come on, really? Really? Yeah. How often have you served other organizations? Allow God to influence you by doing that. Jesus influenced my actions, and he also informs my emotions. He informs my emotions. I find myself getting more emotional. I like it, actually. I feel more alive. I like it, but I also notice that my emotions aren't necessarily accurate. When I find out that we're low on our Go Cincinnati numbers, all of a sudden I start getting paranoid. I start getting fearful. I start having anxiety. I go, oh no, oh no. Crossroads is getting big enough to where people think they're not needed. Oh no, oh no, no, no. We're going to start becoming just a place where people go in the weekends. Oh no. I start getting all freaked out and paranoid. And I realize, whoa, 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 whoa. Relax here. Relax. Yes, speak into those things, but I let my emotions get the most of me. Jesus said this about anxiety in the book of Luke. He says this. And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to a span of life? If then you are not able to do as small a thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? He says, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry. Then he says, because tomorrow will have enough trouble of its own. Worry about today. Don't worry about it. In fact, in the Bible, there's about 365 separate instances of not fearing. One for every day. Don't fear. Don't fear. I find that when we get fearful, when we get angry, so oftentimes our emotions are getting the most of us, and my king informs my emotions, helps me realize that sometimes my emotions are not articulating reality. You ever notice this? How oftentimes we get the biggest emotional response when our slice of dust is infringed upon? We're driving to work and someone cuts us off. Oh, come on! Yeah, yeah. We're getting all upset. Oh, I can't believe it. Do you get the same amount of upset when somebody has a racial act done to them? The same love. Or we're worried, we're paranoid. Our girlfriend, oh, my girlfriend, is she going to break up with me? Oh, I hope she doesn't break me out. And we fixate with it. Or my boyfriend, is he going to ask me out on a date? Or is he going to marry me? Is he going to marry me every day? How is he going to marry? Is this the Valentine's Day? Is this the Christmas? And it's this fear, this anxiety. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, man, if he doesn't ask me soon, maybe I should break up with him and start from scratch. But if I break up with him, it's going to take me at least 6 months to another year. But if I keep going longer, I put it in a, oh, and we angst. And do we have the same emotional angst about a girl who's kidnapped and forced into sex slavery? No, we don't. Our emotions, unless they're informed by Jesus, only get riled up when our little slice of the pie is infected and affected. You know, we get upset. Oh, no, I better get the promotion. Oh, I can't. Oh, gosh, I got to get that. I want to get. Do we get the same level of angst or more when there's a neighbor, a coworker of ours, who we know that doesn't understand who Jesus is, and they're in the hospital, and we go, oh. Do we lose sleep over somebody's eternal soul? Do we lose sleep over that? And again, I'm talking to those of us right now who claim ourselves in the downline of Jesus. If you're not, then of course you wouldn't lose sleep over that. You have a different way to categorize that and think through that. I'm just asking us to think. What do you get most emotional about? It's probably about things that affect you, not the way of love, the good news of somebody else. Jesus not only influences my actions, he not only informs my emotions, but he also forms my dreams. He forms my dreams. My dreams look different today than they looked a decade ago. They look different today than they looked 20 years ago. They do. You ever notice there's a whole cottage industry about dreams in our country? Go after your dream. Achieve your dream. You believe you can achieve. Dream catcher, dream maker. Make it. You know, only in an affluent country like ours can we have dreams. I mean, most of the rest of the world is like, my dream, to have food today. That's my dream. I want food. My dream, to see my parents again. That's my dream. And I don't think there's anything wrong with dreams either. I think it's a blessing by God that we live in a country where we can have dreams beyond having food. I think it's awesome. I really do. I think it's an awesome, ooh, a little reflection in there. Huh? Yeah, I'm blinding you. Yes. I'm going to put it on you. Okay, yes. But I'll tell you what, my dreams have been changed. I'll tell you one of my dreams I used to have. I've written two books. You probably wouldn't know that because no one bought any of them. But I wrote two books, and I might write another one someday. But I'll tell you, my original dream for wanting to write a book back in seminary, my original dream was I would love to be an author. Brian Tome, author. And what about that? What was the dream? Well, a number of different facets for it. Number one, people I saw who thought I was stupid wouldn't think I was stupid. Number two, people in seminary who thought that my ideas were just really out there and weird, I could say, dude, did you get published? I did. My dream initially a long time ago wasn't to be an author so that I could put truth in a different media in a unique way that people could read something and pore over it, underline it, think about it. That's one that that wasn't part of my dream. It was like, so everyone knows Brian Tome is the man. That was my dream. I was a part of that, and I could go thing after thing after thing, and my dreams have been formed. They've been tweaked. They've been adjusted, and they're still being adjusted. My king is still forming my dreams. Some of us have a dream for a family. Why? Why? Is your dream for a family so that you can follow in the brainwashing that we receive starting at 2 years old? Is your dream for a family so that Christmas can be what you wanted it to be? Or is your dream for a family because you see God moves uniquely in families and you want to actually have your own DNA on your downline and maybe foster kids you adopt and other stuff because you want them in your household so for two decades you can train them to be Navy SEAL Kingdom Warriors. That's the role of family. Long-term discipleship, long-term growth, long-term modeling, long-term changing of the culture, I never thought about that. Well, Adam doesn't think about that. Adam thinks of kids actualizing him. Adam thinks of family being there in lonely times. Your family is a wonderful, beautiful thing, but what's the dream for it? How does it work? Money, possessions, what's our dream there? I have friends of ours that had a dream to have a house on a lake. Never been there. I'm sure it's nice. But interesting, they have it. And you know why? I believe God blessed that dream because their dream was always to have a place where they could send battered women for a vacation. It was to have a place where the orphan or the downtrodden could have a time of respite. And yes, they used the place. Yes, God has blessed them with that place. But that's a byproduct because the dream was really to have this thing that was a blessing to others. And God does bless us just for ourselves. Why? Because he's a king. He's a good king. He brings good news. I'm just trying to ask the thing, why do we have the dreams that we have? And are they really, aren't they just, most of us, just a reflection of our realm? We need to start getting to where God is. Last verse, Luke 14, Jesus says this. He says, now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. He cannot be in my downline. He cannot be in a good relationship with me. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Woo! My word, where's Euro Jesus when you need him? Where's precious moments Jesus when you need him? Man, let's have a Sunday school teacher tell this one. I like how a Sunday school teacher would say, my word, wow. Yeah, you don't hear this one talked about very often. And I don't really fully even know what all this means. I'm not sure exactly what he means. Hate your father and mother, wife and child. Well, he means hate. He says it, but he obviously doesn't mean they're dishonor them, do them bad, because my king tells me to die for my wife. That's what my king tells me, to die for my wife. My king tells me to provide for my children. My king tells me to get a J-O-B, get a J-O-B and put food on the table. So he's not anti-family, but that thing doesn't really bother me. It doesn't struggle. I don't struggle with it. Why? Because Jesus is more important than Libby. That's why. Jesus is more important than Lena, Jacob, Mariah. He just is for me. He is. He is. And so when you come under the kingship of Jesus, hard sayings like that aren't that hard because you get your good king. You get your good. And then he says other things about renouncing all things. He says things like, pick up your cross and follow me daily. And in our culture, we don't even know what this means. We think, well, Brian, I got a bad back. That's my cross to bear. We all have a cross to bear. This whole thing in our culture, it's become it's become earrings, it's become jewelry, it's become validation in a church somewhere. Let's put it up. And I'm not anti-cross, whether it's a thing. I'm really not. People want sometimes, why doesn't Crossroads have a cross? How come we're not anti the cross? We'll pull it out. We want to talk about it, and it's a good visual thing. But the cross wasn't a symbol of Jesus till hundreds of years after he was gone. Jesus says, pick up your cross and follow me. What he was saying, that people heard that, didn't think that he was talking about a religious symbol. It was a means of execution. It would be as if the second Adam came for the first time to America today, and he would say, pick up your electric chair, put it on a dolly, and drag it around wherever you go. It's as if he would say, take your lethal injection, put it inside of your pocket, and walk around. What he's saying is, be ready to go at a moment, pick up your cross, and follow me daily, meaning, I am nothing, your kingdom is everything, I'm not going to try to preserve my life, I'm going to try to purport your kingdom. I'm not about my speck of dust. I'm about you. I renounce all things. And of course, I don't all the time. I got Adam's blood that goes through me. But there's moments when we say, I renounce. I pick up my cross. I'm ready to submit. And I just say again freshly in front of everyone, God, I'm thankful for the opportunities you've blessed me with, everything you've given me. And of all the blessings I have, whether they're material, whether they're family, whether they're intellectual gifts, whether they are opportunities I have, I just have to say publicly, they can all go away. They can all go away. And I just want you. They can all leave. As long as you want me to have any of those things, I take them, but I renounce them as identifying me. I renounce them as having any allegiance to me.